Der Fußball ist zurück in der zweiten Liga.
Bravo, macht Tempo, wartet auf Harte. Zwanke kommt und jetzt ist es Klos. Also Arminia Bielefeld.
Penny, 2-0. 2-0 für den FC St. Pauli.
Diese
Flanke, Tor, nächster Treffer.
Ist heuer Fernandes mit vorne. Ja klar ist er mit vorne. Kittel mit der Ecke, Puyatmann und da!
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Zweite Bundesliga podcast. Today, we're going to discuss all the action from a magical match day 28. The fans were back. We saw ultra scenes bouncing up and down and heaps of pyro. I mean, it's been a long time since we've seen such great scenes in the stadiums, and the atmosphere for all nine games was absolutely spectacular. And the action on the pitch itself was also fantastic as well. Today, we'll discuss all the action, but to help me go through all of the games from match day 28, it's not Eva Lotte Bollett. She is unavailable, but we've got the next best thing. A writer for Clubs United covering Nuremberg, it's Florian Singer. Florian, for the first time, welcome to the Zweite Bundesliga podcast.
Glad to be here.
We are thrilled to have you on the podcast and bringing such a wealth of knowledge, not only about Nuremberg, and we'll talk about them in section two of this podcast, but also about the wider Zweite Bundesliga. We saw some incredible results, and especially at the top of the table, a team that in particular kept themselves in the running for promotion was Schalke. They were away at Dynamo on Friday night in front of just over 30,000. This was a very fascinating game. One player in particular was very much involved for Dynamo, which was Paul Ville, but we'll talk about him in a moment. Dynamo got a good start to this game. They had a few opportunities. They certainly looked the more dangerous early. But as has been the case with them this season, it only takes one little mistake for it all to unravel. And just before halftime, let's just say they were a bit casual in possession. Schalke with a very soft press. Possession's turned over. Tirota is doesn't look like he's in a great scoring position, but Paulville fouls him. So it's a penalty. Harms Osmus goes to the spot. Tirota scores. It's goal number 20 for the season. And just after halftime, Schalke would score again. Usually it's one of Schalke's weakest defensive points after halftime. They tend to concede quite a lot after the break, but they got ahead. Dominic Drexler's wonderful whipped in ball found Tirota, who was unopposed. Don't know how you'd miss him. You know, he's only the all-time leading goal scorer in the league. He heads past Kevin Braul. Braul got a hand to it, but it wasn't enough. Dynamo started to work back into the game. They had an opportunity and they were able to take it on 70 minutes. Paul Ville, he got on the score sheet. A good header past Martin Freisel. And it was a bit iffy for both sides. Both had chances. Dynamo certainly seemed more likely. We even saw Kerem Çalhanoğlu almost put the ball in his own net after he controlled the ball from his foot, casually ricocheting off his head, and Freisel was to maintain. All in all, Schalke take the 3 points. It's a massive win for them. It keeps them in the running. They're only 2 points off the top of the table. Flo, a massive win for the Royal Blues. They've got some massive games coming up. This was a must-win game for them, and they managed to get it.
Yeah, it was interesting to see because I actually was more impressed with Dresden. I mean, I saw him in Nuremberg the weekend before the break, and they were sort of caught off guard in the first half hour in that game. And now against Schalke, they were really, really impressive. You can actually really see how Gerino Capretti has already implemented his system there. They're playing a 4-3-3. They're pressing a whole lot. This is really intense. They just get unraveled by sort of almost unexplainable mistakes like on the penalty.
Yeah, I mean, it was so unnecessary. And you look at where Tirota was, and it didn't seem like a particularly dangerous situation. It didn't really require a foul. It didn't look like Tirota was in a position where he could score, despite even being on the edge of the six, because his avenues for passing to try and, you know, put the ball into the middle were very closed off from the Dynamo defense. But Yeah, it was just unnecessary. And then you look at the second goal, and Tim Knipping, who's been very good since returning, he gets completely out-muscled in that situation. One quick ball, and I, again, really don't know how you don't see number nine in white. He's pretty... like, the scouting report would suggest he's the one who's going to get the goals for Schalke. He has 21 of their 56 this season. And an interesting trade, if we look at the stats, Schalke, despite being maybe a bit poor defensively in second halves of games, they're actually a really good second half team. And if I'm not mistaken, they are equal top for the most goals scored in the second half of games with 36. So it's quite interesting. But what did you think of Schalke's performance as a whole? As we knew heading into the game, Peter Hermann, who was an assistant under Jupp Heynckes, joining the team for the rest of the season. What did you think of Schalke's performance under Mike Buskins? Obviously, it's a caretaker role. There's probably not really scope for him to be full-time manager next season. But what did you see from them in that sort of 3-4-3 formation that they tend to play?
It's in general, I'd say it was probably their worst performance under Buskins so far. I think that Dresden actually had them sort of under control, but still they sort of managed to find their way into that match, and they had Thomas Overhand back, so that's also big, I think, for the remainder of the season, because he's like their best creator when it comes to set pieces and also to crosses and so on. So I think it was sort of almost, I was at the point that I thought, well, maybe even after the goal by Will, I thought maybe they could get back into it, Dresden, and because Schalke, it didn't look like they were not going to concede another goal. But in the end, they sort of bore it out. And yeah, I'm still not 100% convinced that they're at that level that they need, but they've sort of come to the point where they're at least consistent. They get their goals, Terodde is scoring, all of that sort of is working now, even if it's still not 100% convincing. But it might actually be finding consistency at the right point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at their schedule, their fixture, the next three games are brutal. Heidenheim at home, and we know Heidenheim could be the thorn in a lot of promotion sides heading into the end of the season. Darmstadt away, and then Bremen at home. That's very tough for them. And then the final three games, Sandhausen away, St. Pauli at home on Saturday night, and then they end the season at the Max Morlock Stadion. So they're getting all of the top six, essentially, to end the season with Sandhausen sprinkled in the middle. It's going to be a big ask for them, but we'll see if they can get it done. Dynamo, they get to play a lot of the teams that are near to them in that bottom half, excluding Karlsruhe towards the end of the season. It's going to be a big ask to maybe climb ahead of Sandhausen, but we'll see. They get Sandhausen, actually, in a big six-pointer on the weekend. Now let's make a move to Sandhausen's game against Werder Bremen at the Weserstadion. On paper, you would be forgiven for thinking that Bremen would absolutely cakewalk Sandhausen. We know that Sandhausen have had their troubles defensively, but they've improved with some of the acquisitions they've had in the winter, and we'll mention one in particular in a moment. Bremen were pretty dominant throughout this game, lots of control of possession. They really were allowed to do whatever they want, but Sandhausen, credit to them, were very astute defensively. Especially in the first 70 minutes, very compact. They had strong play from the midfield. Tommy Tribble, in particular, was really a real thorn in the side for Bremen, and they had a real tough task trying to get past him. And Bremen, as we know, were missing a good chunk of their back three. It was a makeshift back three. And the one time they were tested, they conceded. 64 minutes in, Pascal Testrot gets his ninth goal of the campaign. It was an avoidable goal, it has to be said. And, oh boy, not great from all parties. But Testrot, very much endearing himself to the Sandhausen faithful. But the lead only lasted 9 minutes. The resistance finally broke for Zandhausen. Marvin Dux, who missed the Darmstadt game with COVID, he comes back. He scores a wonderful goal. Romano Schmidt's pass was absolutely perfect. Dux's one-time finish into the bottom corner past Patrick Drouves. And then Bremen pretty much threw everything, including the kitchen sink, but they could not find a winner. It's a great point for Zandhausen, despite the fact, let's be frank, they were completely dominated in this game. Flo, what was the big takeaway for Bremen in this one? You know, they've been almost unbeatable under Oli Werner, but this one will sting a little bit, knowing it was a home game, ultras were back, and they really struggled against the Zandhausen side, who can concede goals, it has to be said.
It's interesting because it was sort of the big trend of the weekend, basically, was if you have possession, you don't win. Because I when I look at like the possession stats, it's like of the eight teams or of the nine teams, if you look at the nine teams that had more possession than the opponent, only Ingolstadt won. Everybody else either lost or only drew. So it's interesting that in this game in particular, because I think the stats were at about, I don't know, 75% possession for Bremen, but they couldn't find a way to create sort of a lot of meaningful chances. I mean, of course, if you have the ball that long, you have your chances and you get your opportunities. And if you score more, or if you score early, this game probably just goes to like a 2-0 or 3-0, something like that. But you don't, and then it becomes really, really difficult. What I found interesting was if you look at like what Bremen was trying to do, they were crossing the ball so much. I think Weisscout has it at like, I think, 45 crosses into the box, and it was just basically just ball after ball coming in. And crosses are easy to defend, especially if you have a defense with Dumic and with Zirov, who are really probably the integral part of the renaissance under Alois Schwarz, because along with Tom Trebol, these three sort of, they make the defense more compact, they get the ball out. Of course, you can still score on them, but it's become a lot more difficult in the last couple of weeks. And it's really Alois Schwarz doing Alois Schwarz things. It's being compact and just sort of being a bit opportunistic and grinding out results and getting a point here and there.
Yeah, it's not about being pretty. It's about getting something out of the game. And you look at the situation they're in. Currently, P15, 3 points ahead of Dynamo. We usually say 40 points is guaranteed safety. I think that's a fair marker in terms of the season. They obviously have Dynamo on the weekend, which is going to be a massive game, and they could really put some headway from avoiding that relegation playoff. But yeah, the suspects you mentioned in Zvirov, Dumic, who they brought in over in the winter, same with Trebol. You know, you look at the statistics and, you know, Trebol had the most successful tackles, most interceptions in the game. He had actually more interceptions than Bremen had for the entirety of the contest. I mean, that says a lot. And obviously, he would have enjoyed that, playing against one of his former employers. So you could tell he would have certainly had a good feeling. And yeah, that's all it took. One chance. And in this league especially, where conversion efficiency is so important, that's all they needed. One shot. And Pavlenka, who virtually had nothing to do throughout the game, was completely done over. But yeah, massive game for them. We look at what Bremen did. We suggest they'll get Veljkovic, Toprak, you know, Friedel back for those last few games. And their next three games are massive. St. Pauli away, Nürnberg, Schalke away. This is finally one of the biggest tests for Oli Werner, not only as the coach of Bremen, but of his coaching career, because we've spoken so much about how much he's improved the Bremen outlook, considering the start of the season was less than expected. But he has a real chance of not only gaining promotion, but winning the league. Win these three games, or take 7 points out of 9, you'd have to say they're a front runner to win the league. What do you think? What do you think's been the major difference with Bremen? Obviously, Anfang is been and gone. Anfang also meaning beginning. It was a new beginning for Bremen under Oli Werner. What's probably the one thing that stands out in the style of play that that Werner has implemented since becoming manager?
It's interesting because Anfang is a coach that is really, really focused on getting his teams to sprint, to run, to get into these places. And actually, Werner has sort of relaxed the intensity to a point, but made them create a lot more up from their chances. He's implemented Dux and Füllkrug a lot better, I feel. They get into positions. It's still not the point that they're perfect. This league, everybody in this league needs to be lucky at one point and get their points from small mistakes that the opponent makes or from failure to convert. But as such, I think the restructuring, also going to like a three at the back and giving the wing backs, getting them to get more width, all of this sort of works to Bremen's advantage, even though it's I think when you look at fans of the team, they're still sort of frustrated by the way they play, because it's not this really convincing. There's not a whole lot of punch in there, but they're getting their chances, and I think as such, he's come in and he's created sort of a consistency in at least being in games and being concentrated and all that.
100% agree. I think you mentioned that they're getting a lot more shots on net, and the proof is in the pudding. The fact that Niklas Füllkrug and Marvin Ducksch individually had more shots than Sandhausen speaks volumes to the amount of opportunities that those two are having. And you look at the scores, you know, Ducksch has 17, Füllkrug has 14. I mean, it speaks volumes because Füllkrug has really come alive since Oli Werner has become the manager of Werder Bremen. But yeah, it is a daunting road for Bremen ahead. But if they can get past it, one would suggest that promotion is only around the corner. And lastly, let's go to our final Group 1 game. We're at the Ossis-Stadion in Rostock. It's Hansa, it's St. Pauli. We mentioned last time the police presence would have a very tricky time with these two sides facing off. There is no love lost between Hansa and St. Pauli. It seemed as if Rostock, though, got off to the perfect start. Medic getting completely dispossessed, legally initially, but let's be frank, he got completely bulldozed by Jean Verhoek. Verhoek finds Simon Ryan. Ryan gets the opening goal, and it looks like Rostock could have to this perfect start. But of course, correctly, the video assistant referee chalks off for a pretty blatant foul by Jean Verhoek, although he didn't seem too convinced, but let's be frank, it was a bulldozer. St. Pauli did have a chance in the first half to take the lead through Guido Borgstaller. Marcus Kolker makes a very good save, and the team's going all square at the break. This is where I think the game got really weird for me in terms of what St. Pauli were doing. A halftime change, we saw Becker go off for James Lawrence. St. Pauli switching to a five at the back, and they really lost control of the game from halftime onwards. Hansa continued to go forward, and they would eventually get their goal. Nico Neidhart, from the tightest of angles, with the goal completely closing, he's able to pick the ball into the back of the net after a wonderful cross from Caligari Rizzuto. And that goal was enough for Hansa Rostock to make it four wins on the trot. They move to 11th place. And they are looking ever so closer to surviving and keeping another season. It's quite interesting, if we talk about Hansa for a moment, Flo, that they looked at all sorts of trouble. But since March, they're scoring goals. They're defending a lot better, as we saw in this game. They look completely different to the side that literally could not score a goal at home, and we were convinced that someone had put a hex on their goals. What's changed for Hansa Rostock? What has Jens Hartl done to help transform this team from a side that was certainly looking as if they were going to be in the playoff to a team that is edging closer to safety.
It's sort of interesting because I think actually the point where it all changed was that loss against Nuremberg, where they already you already saw some changes that were made. They created chances, they just didn't finish them. And then after that, sort of everybody just clicked. And what Jens Hertel's strength is that he gets his team to be very, very flexible. When you look at just the last couple of games against Schalke, he played in like a 4-5-1. Against Kiel, he's in a 4-3-3. Against St. Pauli, he plays a 3-5-2. So there's a lot of like formational flexibility that he always had instilled. But now it seems like he gets to the point where it just suits the opponent really, really well. And this was sort of, I think, at the heart of St. Pauli's problem was really that he found the perfect kryptonite for the way St. Pauli played in the first half, or usually play massive control in the center, having Rein, Fröde, Behrens, and just be really compact, and then getting switch on the switch and sort of in these transitional moments, getting to the point where you catch St. Pauli on the break, as on that chalked off goal. That was really, really convincing. I think they're at that point where they are so flexible that they can cause problems for a whole lot of teams because the tactical nuance is there, and now it's working.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I if I go back to the Schalke game, and it's quite fascinating the way they did it, which is they didn't have to do a lot, but it was just the quick conviction. You know, two of their goals came from Schalke corners, essentially, quick on the break. Ingolson in particular is one player that I've highlighted in this game, and his form has been very, very strong over the past few weeks. Even if he's not getting on the score sheet, he looks dangerous. He's creating for Verhoek. He's considering he couldn't get a look in early on in the season, him playing in sort of a weird hybrid second striker, or he can play in that midfield five if necessary. I mean, he's been very, very impressive for me. In terms of St. Pauli, they were the only top four side to lose on the weekend. They dropped a third. They've got Bremen on the weekend. That's going to be a massive game on Saturday. What do they need to fix? Because it certainly seemed to me, watching the game, that the game was gone at halftime when he made such a negative change to try and compensate for Rostock's ability to counter quickly. And they still got caught out regardless. So what does Timo Schulz need to do, do you think, to whether it's a personnel change? Does he change the formation? What's the thing that he needs to fix heading into what is going to be a massive patch for St. Pauli?
I think that what really stands out is like how much they depend on Daniel Kofi-Cherry, because if he's not playing well, the team is not playing well. And he had an off day against Rostock. And this dependency sort of creates all sorts of problems, because if he's not there distributing balls or creating chances, then you're at that point where it becomes easy for other teams to defend him. So I don't know if this late in the season you can change a whole lot about the dependency on a single player, because he's so important. And if you look at like, they're usually playing a 4-4-2 diamond. So, of course, with Cherry at that 10, at the top of the diamond, then, of course, he's going to be the guy that's distributing. He's going to be the focal point of the attack. And the thing is, I mean, if you look at, we'll look at Nuremberg in a second, they also have that 4-4-2 diamond, a whole lot of dependency on Mats Möller-Daly, and Robert Klaus changed it to a 4-2-3-1 with more flexible, he calls them roving tens, like the three midfield players. Maybe that's a way to go about it, to create a bit more defensive stability in the center and also have like three more creative players behind a single striker that's also moving about. Maybe that's a way to go about it to change it a bit. But St. Pauli's strength, of course, also has been that sort of consistency that they have one system or one formation that works and they stick to it in most of the games. So maybe you go about it that way, or you just say, we'll stick it out and we hope that Daniel Kopiciri is back onto, like, his regular level, because, I mean, he came back from World Cup qualifying, probably celebrated a bit. So maybe it was just a blip, but of course that Bremen game is really, really massive. It's like might be the most important game of the season for them.
100%. And then after that game, they've got Sandhausen away, and then they've got three massive games, Darmstadt, Nürnberg, and then Schalke away before ending with Fortuna Düsseldorf. Big games coming up for St. Pauli. Let's see if they can get back to winning ways on the weekend. Let's take our first break, and on the other side, we'll go to our Group 2 games, and we're going to start at the Merckstadion on Ballenfeld Tor. It's Darmstadt and Holstein Kiel. Darmstadt were hoping to return to the top two on match day 28 when they hosted Holstein Kiel. Massive, massive game for them. It'd be interesting to see how Kiel continued to respond after that four-game losing streak they won heading into the international break. But they took on a Darmstadt side who we know can put the ball in the back of the net. And that started on 11 minutes. Matthias Bader's cross, intended for Aaron Seidel, missed the tall striker, went through Thomas Dana and into the back of the net. A very embarrassing moment for the goalkeeper. Aaron Seidel has been the go-to guy for Darmstadt in the second half of the season, with Luca Pfeiffer and Philipp Tietz not really firing, but he would score his sixth goal of the campaign on the stroke of half-time. Beautifully finished goal. Dana again. Very unfortunate. But a change at half-time and Kiel were back in the game. Kwasi Rett was the substitution and he got on the score sheet when he was able to deceive the Darmstadt defence and an unawares Marcel Schuhen. But the advantage lasted mere seconds when Braden Manu tapped in a wonderful cross from Fabian Holland and his third goal of the campaign. There was a chance to make it 3-2 for Alexander Mühling. He scored four times from the spot from his five attempts. It's only now four from his six attempts, as a relatively average penalty was well saved from Marcel Schuhen. That was the score in the end. 3-1 winners were Darmstadt. They are now second behind Werder Bremen. Whew. Kiel, on the other hand, it's another defeat for them. It's been a rough patch for them. It's not going to get any easier. But let's focus on Darmstadt, because at the start of the season, it was Tietz and Pfeiffer. They were the best combination going around in terms of the strikers. Scoring has gotten a lot tougher for those two, and the guy who stood up has been Aaron Seidel. Is there a difference in approach from Thorsten Lieberkesch with Seidel up top? And are we seeing that more frequently now that Seidel is the go-to guy for Darmstadt?
I don't actually think there's been a whole lot of change in the way Lieberkesch plays the football. This has always been his style, is sort of direct and more going for speed and all that. And it fits the whole Darmstadt DNA, because it's almost a natural evolution to the Dirk Schuster football that was played a bit before. It's a bit more on the playing side. It's not just roofing it long. It's been sort of a bit of a development, but it's just Seidel is just the right guy at the right time when the other two are struggling, gets in there. He's a bit more target man, bit more in that mold, but as such, it's just Darmstadt being Darmstadt and playing their style and still being up there, which is in itself an achievement, and they're giving everybody a run for their money.
100%, and you are right, being that he's the right he was the right person at the right time. And it certainly seemed a bit dicey at the start of the calendar year when you see two guys who were literally scoring for the fun of it, not being able to put the ball on the back of the net. Certainly seems teams were playing them a little bit differently. Seidel brings them another dimension. They could be a bit more direct in the way that they approach the game. And also they've got someone who is just a good few inches taller than majority of centre-backs in the league. So that's, if you're going to do what Bremen do, which was cross it a billion times, you've got someone who has at least got a distinct height advantage and is a decent header of the football. As we see, their next three games are gigantic. Nuremberg away on the top Spieler, Schalke, then St. Pauli. Big theme here. Everyone in the top four has to play each other except Bremen and Darmstadt. They did that before the break. So how exciting the fact that we've got a massive title tilt, promotion tilt. And there's going to be some tears, let's be honest, but we don't know who it's going to be until the final match day. What do you rate Darmstadt's chances of sneaking promotion? Because it's, let's be honest, I don't think many of us believe that they could be in a position to gain promotion. There was also an argument that maybe Thorsten Lindbergkjær wasn't the best option available in terms of managerial hirings. He's proven that a lot of us wrong. Do you think they, with the style of football they play, the setup and the system, do you think they have a really strong case to gain promotion?
It's sort of interesting because you mentioned Thorsten Lindbergkjær. It might in the end, or right now looking at the table, it's the two teams that Marcus Anfang left up top. And they sort of put into question how good is he as a coach if these other coaches just are even better. I think Darmstadt plays in a way that is sort of almost emblematic of the Zweite Bundesliga, because they're not a possession team. They're a quick transition team. And there are a lot of teams that struggle with that when you play against them, especially if it's sides that focus more on at least trying to play a bit more football. And the thing is, Darmstadt, at the beginning of the campaign, it was awful to watch for me. It was just sitting back, hoofing it along, and just trying to get there, and lots of transitions, not a whole lot of build-up play, not a whole lot of positional attacks. And now they've evolved to a point where it's bearable to watch them. They're still not my favorite team to watch, but you can sort of watch them. And that evolution actually makes me think that, along with the squad that's at the right, as I said, at the right time, you have Seidel coming in when Pfeiffer and Tietz are struggling, you have sort of a consistency at some places, like left back like Holland and Kempe and Melem. They're all good, decent Zweite Liga players that would probably not fit in the Bundesliga, but they're good for that and they can cause a lot of problems. So I've actually, when I look at it, for me, I think that I have them at the end of the season in the playoffs, ahead of St. Pauli, after Bremen and Schalke. And then probably falling to whoever it is that's up there. But I think it's going to be tense and tight. And they sort of have the advantage that the last three games then they play at Düsseldorf and Paderborn. The last three, they're not against the top teams. Mm. They know after these three games now that with Nürnberg, Schalke, and St. Pauli, they know where they're at. And if they're still in the running, then they can sort of play a bit more, well, not relaxed, but they have opponents that probably have nothing to play for anymore, because I think Aue is going to be relegated three games before the end of the season.
Yeah, I think we're pretty comfortable with that assessment. I mean, the Paderborn game is interesting because they're such a strong away team and they've proven time and time again this season that they can cause a little bit of trouble. So that might be a little bit of a red herring. For Kiel, though, yeah, not great. They know how to possess the football. That's something that we've seen under Marcel Rapp. But they're really hard. I don't know. Just a quick word on Kiel. I find they're a very hard team to gauge at the moment. You know, they're still trying to really integrate the Rapp system. But for me, I think this is more or less a let's get to the end of the season and let's reassess the entirety of the squad, because it's a weird balance. It doesn't really seem to blend to what Rapp is trying to do.
Yeah, I totally agree on that one. It's sort of, they probably don't have the players for what he's trying to do, and now he started experimenting with the formation again, because Marcel Rapp is usually a guy where you know he's going to play with three at the back, and then he's going to usually go for something like a 3-5-2 in most cases. And he's changed that in the last couple of games a lot. So maybe he's sort of trying to get to a point where it's just like, let's get across the finish line and see what we're there. I found the whole setup against Darmstadt really weird, because it was sort of, if you look at it, he tried to close the center, especially in the second half when it was a switch to something like a 4-4-2 diamond, where it was like, is that really the approach you want to go against Darmstadt, who are like, who have their speed on the outside? I was not quite sure what they did. And you wrote in your show notes that they folded like a deck of cards for the third goal. And I think, especially sometimes I feel not just for the third goal, but just for like everything. And so it'll be interesting to see, because I rate Marcel Rapp as such, but he's not found a way to get with that squad and then sort of get into their heads and try implement what he's usually trying to do.
Yeah, we'll see. I think with him, it's definitely going to be a let's see what the team looks like match day one of next season. Don't think they'll be in a position where they're going to be in too much danger. They've got a 6-point cushion to Dinamo for P16, so I think they should be okay. But yeah, I get the feeling that squad could be hitting the reset button for the start of next season. A team that's is known for maybe causing more headaches for the teams at the top is Heidenheim. They took on Nürnberg in what was going to be a massive game for Nürnberg. Given the results that were happening elsewhere, they knew a win was vital to keep themselves in the mix. How did they begin? Well, they conceded in the opening 3 minutes. It was a cross from Tobias Moore. Tim Kleinied's headering virtually at the edge of the 6-yard box past Christian Martina. They would concede just before half-time through Maurice Malone. And then Kleinied's got on the score sheet. Once again, he's now got 9 goals this season. Manuel Schaefer got a goal late, albeit a consolation. He's got 4 goals this season. Robert Klaus didn't really mince his words. Translating, we didn't have the desire to score goals today. It certainly seemed that way. They were competent possessing the football throughout the game, but the lack of impetus in the final third was very telling compared to what Heidenheim were doing, which was creating chances. They looked very dangerous, especially with crosses and coming across the pitch. A really poor showing for Nürnberg, who had so much to play for.
Yeah, I think that desire, I think Robert Klaus used the word Gier, which translated to greed also, and I think sort of sounds like we didn't have the goblins that had all that wanted the gold. So but that's really what it was. It was getting up to the final third, and then there's a lot of wrong decisions there. You take on players where you shouldn't be taking on players. You play the wrong pass. You don't get into that final shooting position. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of good chances. I mean, probably the best chance of the game, apart from the goal, was Pascal Köpke, even before Heidenheim scored their goal after 3 minutes. I think Köpke was like after 80 seconds or something. And that was it. After that, Yes, Nuremberg was in control. They had possession, like two-thirds of the game. They had, but it was all sort of, yeah, it was a bit almost pointless possession because it didn't get into these positions where you can actually score or have meaningful chances. And that's been a problem for them. They had it. They created more after switching to that 4-2-3-1, which I talked about when we were talking about Sampaoli. They sort of switched it up a bit, but against Heidenheim, who are just so good at defending. I mean, they probably play the best low block in the Zweite Bundesliga. And if you, I looked it up after, because Peter Hecking, the CEO of Nuremberg, said that he thought the game was over after 3 minutes, because if you concede at Heidenheim, you're just done by. I looked it up. In the last three seasons, there's only three teams that even took 1 point after conceding in Heidenheim after getting a goal behind. So you see that once you concede there, it's really, really tough because they defend so well. I mean, Mainkai and Hüsing are probably the most well-oiled center-back pairing in the division. So all of that. And then, of course, they also have that ability to hurt you when they capitalize on mistakes. I mean, let's be honest, the first goal is a mistake, as because you can't get to the point where Toby Moore even can cross. You have to put more pressure on, and Kilian Fischer was off, really got sort of a telling off for that right after the goal by Robert Klaus. On the second one, Tim Handwerker just plays such an abysmal pass, and then they capitalize on that. And on the third one, it's just in transition and it's not really well defended. So if you're not concentrated, if you're not 100% there, Heidenheim are going to hurt you. And this could probably be like a theme for the next couple of games, because they still have Schalke also.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Heidenheim is it was peak Frank Schmidt in the way that they really set up defensively, really strong shape. Mainkai and Hüsing were fantastic. But you can also see when they actually transition, their wing players, I always look at Marnon Busch on the right side. He's always bombing down with reckless abandon. But, you know, unlike some fullbacks where they go forward and then once they, you know, the ball's turned over, they get out of position, he's usually on it straight away. And obviously he's a coach's dream to have a fullback who, you know, can really put himself to work. I think that's a problem that I found watching Nuremberg for a lot of the season, this season, is that the fullbacks get themselves into really aggressive positions in possession, but when they lose the footy, they are immediately under pressure. You can see Sorensen and Schindler in particular are almost sitting ducks, and it invites those 3-on-2, 4-on-2 attacks that, you know, teams can catch them out, and obviously really good attacking teams just pump the ball into the back of the net. I mean, even we saw Ingolstadt do it to them many, many weeks ago, and we don't really consider Ingolstadt as the be all and end all of attacking, but it showcased the flaws that they've got in that back four, that system that Klaus likes to play. So we look at where Nuremberg are now. Darmstadt, Bremen, they get St. Pauli a few weeks later, end the season at Schalke. So they might, it seems like they're out at the moment. They're only 4 points behind, and a lot can happen, as we know. Nothing is as it seems in the Zweite Bundesliga, but it's hard to see them coming back, because that loss on the weekend seemed so pivotal. Just that points gap seems a bit too much. I know you watch a lot of Nuremberg, which must be tough at times, because they play some, let's say, interesting football. And their football has come under criticism at times. And they've got Darmstadt, home game, Saturday night. Can really put a marker on a team that we kind of know what they're going to do, which is be very direct in their approach. What if I'm going to put you in the coach's shoes? You're Robert Klaus. What do you think will be the best way for Nürnberg to prepare for the second best team in Darmstadt?
It's tough because you already basically put out there what the problem is with the fullbacks. It really doesn't matter on the right if it's Valentini or Fischer. They push up and then they're not great in transitioning backwards. So, and especially against Darmstadt, who like usually play their flat 4-4-2 when they have two people on the wings, this is going to be a problem. So the question is, what do you do? You know that Darmstadt are not great when they have possession. Is it? It's a home game. You can't just sit there and be like, there you go, have the ball, and we'll be the ones transitioning. So you really have to think about how can you put pressure on Darmstadt in a way that could actually hurt them. And I don't see Nürnberg winning that one, because no matter what combination you put out there, it's still going to be tough. They're also without Fabian Nürnberger, so Tom Kraus is going to be on the pitch probably. So the question really is, what do you do? Do you stick to your 4-2-3-1 with the roving tens? You try to create chances. What I would definitely do is switch up front, because Pascal Koepke sort of has been, yeah, he scored, but most of the goals were just like he's lucky that he's where the ball drops, and not because he created these situations. So I'd probably make a switch there. Maybe even go for Manuel Scheffler, who's just a really, really tough, compact, physical guy up front. You can hurt the central defenders, because I mean, Darmstadt also has like really physical central defenders in the back. So, or you go completely different direction and be like Erik Shuranov or Mikola Dovedan or something, and be more mobile and agile. But I really don't envy Robert Klaus in what he's going to do, because Darmstadt is exactly the type of team that Nürnberg has trouble with. They're quick, they transition well, they have all the right tools to hurt them. They run a lot every time Nürnberg has to be really, really physical and run a whole lot. They can do it, but as you see against Heidenheim, at one point they struggle. And maybe even at some points they get caught out, they get a bit lazy, well, not lazy, but they get sort of exhausted in a way. So all of this is a really, really tough ask of the team. It'll be interesting to see if they can get a point or even a win. If they actually won that one, I think they'd be right back in it, because then they would finally have beaten like a top side, which they haven't done all season. If you exclude Hamburg to a point, because, well, they're not up there right now. So if you look at like the top six, the other five teams, they've gotten one win against Heidenheim at home, which was a 4-0, which was great. But other than that, they lost to Bremen at home, they lost at Darmstadt, they lost against St. Pauli at home, they lost at Schalke. So all of these, there's not a whole lot of points that they've taken against these sides. And this is the point where I'm with you when you're saying they're not going to get up there, because every time you come up against opposition like that, you see them fall short. And to actually get to a point where right now these results are coming, that would be an immense development, and it's probably they're probably not there yet.
Yeah, a team that is not there yet, and it seems like they haven't been there yet for the fourth consecutive year, is Hamburg SV. We know around this time of the year it all kind of falls apart, and well, it certainly has done, and the defeat to Paderborn at home has almost put the final nail in the coffin. If they don't win tonight, of course, by the time you're listening to this, that game has been concluded, and we'll have no idea if Hamburg did in fact win that home game against Erzgebirge Aue. But at the here and now, they are a long way off being even in contention for the playoff, and that defeat was a bone-crushing one, just mentally, and it was a peak performance from them. Plenty of possession. They had the most of the ball, second most, for the entire match day. They had tons of shots on goal. Actually, that's a lie. They didn't have enough shots on goal, considering the amount of possession they had. They had two goals chalked off, both for offside. Glatzel missed a penalty. And the goals they conceded were so painfully avoidable. Dennis Sabeni scored within 45 seconds. His long-range shot caught out Daniel Hoyer Fernandez right in front of the ultras. We know Hoyer Fernandez is instructed with Volta Ball to be aggressive, be a bit more proactive. But I'm amazed that this hasn't happened more often, where a striker has really had the onus to be like, you know what, I'm going to make him own that 18-yard box in more ways than one. It was a brilliant goal, and it really put Hamburg on the back foot. Sabeni would score again 60 minutes later, and you felt that's probably enough for Paderborn. One player who was outstanding in this game was Yannick Hoots, who was virtually the Paderborn wall, and nothing seemed to go through except those two goals that were chalked off for offside. Yatta offside on both occasions, and it could have definitely been a different game. He did have one momentary lapse of misjudgment, let's say, when Jorgi Chakvetadze's effort seemed rather harmless, but it skidded off the turf, off the chest of Hoots, through the fingers, and into the back of the net. But it was all but a consolation goal. What does this mean for Hamburg? Well, with a game in hand, they are 8 points away from fourth place, 9 away from the playoff. They have the easiest schedule out of the teams that you would think are in the running, but it would, in my opinion, it does seem a little bit too late for them to make a run. There's going to be a lot of discussions at the end of the season, Flo. Is Tim Volta going to be coaching? Are we going to go for a fifth consecutive new coach to start the season? What's gone wrong with them? Because it seems like Hamburg get themselves into the same trap at the same time every season.
It's really fascinating, because if you look at something like expected goals, they should be up there. And this is true for all four of their seasons in the Zweite Bundesliga. Something just doesn't want to work for them. And now, again, at this time, you can even against Paderborn, you can say, well, they're really, really unlucky. It's April and they start losing even more. So actually, it's a bit of being unlucky, and maybe it's just also, in this case, really what you mentioned already, that aggressiveness in the back, it opens them up for goals, for exactly those kind of goals. It's not just that cheeky chip into the back of the net after 40 seconds. Also that second one where it's direct play, and you then, Juan Fernandez doesn't look good on that second one either, let's be honest. So all of that, maybe it's still a bit of like a mental thing that you're thinking, we're the big Bundesliga dinosaur. We need to be up there, and we'll get up there at one point. Now they're going up on their fifth season. I'm also almost entirely convinced that they're not going to make it. Maybe now, if they're coming from behind and not faltering or falling from the top, maybe that will change something. But as such, it's difficult for them, and I don't think they'll make it. I think from a footballing perspective, they're fine. They play okay to well. They're just not converting, and as you said, it's like they have 67 or 68% of possession, and they don't turn it into a whole lot of chances. That might be a problem, but I actually just sometimes it's down to bad luck. If you're consistently not performing 4-4-4 or not being promoted 4-4 years, it's probably not just bad luck. It's maybe internalized in that club to a point. But as you said, maybe it's also this changing up after every season, because you can't, if you don't have consistency in coaching, if you don't have consistency in squad building, you're not going to get there. Because if every coach has a different approach, and you probably, if you look at the last years, you couldn't be further apart from Dieter Hecking to Tim Bajka. I mean, this is, and it basically says the club has no idea what football they want to play. And maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
As such, I would probably give Tim Bajka a second year, even though I don't like him personally, because he's really strange when you talk to him or ask him questions. But that's just part of his job, I think, footballing-wise. He has interesting ideas. So maybe you should just give him another chance. But I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I think that's kind of where they're at. It's weird, though, because we mentioned Nürnberg and they've struggled against the top teams. You look at their resume, Hamburg, they've beaten Darmstadt. They beat them 5-0 away from home. They beat St. Pauli. They've beaten Bremen. They've beaten Schalke. They've beaten Heidenheim. They've won against teams they should win against and then lost to Hanover. You know, they were beaten... they're beaten by Paderborn. They've got a ton of draws in there where they could have easily gone and won those games. It doesn't make sense for them to make a change at the end of the season, because what they've done for the past four seasons is a continuous overflow of things that we want new ideas, we want to try something different, but we're not giving them more than one season, because it's promotional bust mentality. And that might have been fine in the first two seasons, but at some stage it's going to have such a significant effect that eventually promotion will eventually be out of the question. And they'll be just a mid-table team reliving former glories. Remember the clock they had at the stadium. That's kind of where they're at now. You know, they're in danger of becoming what Kaiserslautern were many, many years ago, where we're this big club, we expect to be promoted, and if it doesn't happen, we'll just change everything up again until we get it right. But eventually, you don't get it right, and then out of nowhere, you run out of money, you have to sell the stadium, and you get relegated. And only now we're seeing Kaiserslautern might join us next season. But, you know, that sort of instability that Hamburg have had for so long caught up to them when they were relegated to the Zweite Bundesliga, and they still haven't learned from it. New ideas, new people at the top, and they all fall for the same trap. Like, how is it that people on the outside can see there's a massive problem, but the people running the club opt to just pretend it's not there? It's fine. It's really, really fascinating if they can get some results, but wins, and they need some help. They need the teams above them to take some points. But honestly, I think it's too far gone for them. Good win for Paderborn.
They also have the distraction of the cup. I mean, they're still in the semifinals of the cup. So probably if it's down to, are we going to be on our best against Karlsruhe and Regensburg, or are we going to focus on the game in between, which is against Freiburg at home? I mean, this is probably part of the problem.
Yeah, it is. I mean, wow, there's the opportunity to play in Europe, but, you know, that's probably more, that's just more games. And I don't think you really want that in such a tough division that the Zweite Bundesliga is. Honestly, can't wait for the cup game. And if they make the final, I mean, let's be honest, I think if it's Leipzig or if it's Union, I mean, pretty confident we're all probably backing Hamburg at that point, especially if it's Leipzig. But, it's going to be fascinating. Let's take a final break. On the other side, we'll discuss the final three games of the match day. And we're going to start with the Battle of the Basement. It's Ingolstadt and Erzgebirge Aue. Two teams who are hanging on for dear life are Ingolstadt and Erzgebirge Aue. This was a massive six-pointer. If Ingolstadt lose, you could very much put in the fifth nail in that six-nail coffin. Aue, on the other hand, of course, well, they've got that game in hand against Hamburg, which is happening tonight, but obviously the podcast will be out tomorrow, so that game would have already been happening and played. So, a lot on offer for both teams, especially with Dynamo losing at Schalke. It gives them a little bit of hope, even though it is a long way back for them to get a result of 16th. Well, Aue, as per usual, they like to do things the hard way, and they weren't helped when Prince Owusu inadvertently, I don't know what the hell he was doing. Very clumsy elbow, straight red card. I don't think anyone can really complain about it. It was unnecessary. It was just really, really silly. And Ingolstadt were basically given, here's your opportunity to take the game if you want it. Patrick Schmidt opened the scoring on 24 minutes, and Visa Muslia made it two just moments later. But if you do remember a few match days before, Erzgebirge Aue were in this situation against Holstein Kiel. They were 2-0 down, and it looked like the game was gone. But in that game, they were able to get it back to 2-2. And they did do that. Antonio Jonjic, Soren Gunter. Gunter's goal happening on 89 minutes, and it seemed that the 10 men were going to get a point. But of course, if you remember that game, they conceded in stoppage time. And wouldn't you believe it? It happened again. Andreas Paulsen's rocket from range past a crowd of players and past Martin Manuel. Ingolstadt wins 3-2. What does this mean? It closes the gap for them, between them and Erzgebirge Aue. But they are still 11 points off safety. It's a long, long, long journey for them to find survival. For Aue, well, obviously they've got the game that's happening against Hamburg. But much like Ingolstadt, they are well away from any sort of safety. This game made no sense, but most of these two seasons it's made a lot of sense. Team with poor. We talk about Ingolstadt, a team that really didn't have a very good opening day squad. Wrong coach, followed by another poor coaching hire, followed by Rudiger Rehm. Aue doing the same, but they were less patient with Alexei Shpilevsky. Then they had Mark Hensel, but of course he doesn't have his professional UEFA coaching license. They tried him for a bit, didn't work. They reduced him to assistant manager. Pavel Dojchev took over. But yeah, look, these two teams with six games or seven games remaining, it's a long road for either of them to find survival. It probably doesn't seem likely. But let's talk about this game in particular, because it might give Ingolstadt fans something to smile about. They had this game in control. They took the 2 goals early. They had the lead. And then they made things very, very difficult for themselves. They get the win. It at least gives them a little bit of hope, albeit if it's just 3 points all the same. Your thoughts on what should have been a regulation win that was anything but?
It was weird because I usually don't watch football with my kids, but they were there for that game, and they were like, it was 2-1, and my little one, he's 5, he was like, oh, they have 2, and they have one. No, now they have 2. And he did, and he basically, until the point he had processed that there was a goal, there was another goal. So they just saw like the last five minutes, and they probably both think these are the best teams in the world because they score all the time. It was fun, but these last couple of minutes, but it, as you said, this should not happen. I mean, I think it was Eva who tweeted, like, she didn't understand that Jonjic goal, and I didn't either, because where does the ball go and where does the keeper go? I have really, really no idea. But somehow it's in, and then they equalize. Oh, what's actually a pretty nice move by Hochscheid, and just passing the ball in. And you're like, oh, well, this is typical. They both get a point, so they're basically both down and out forever. And then this Paulsen goal is just such a beauty. I mean, it's I think, if I remember correctly, yeah, Paulson before this game had like 73 minutes in the whole season, and then he gets this goal. It's just, it's a whole lot of stories. But as you said, it shouldn't have been that close because they were in control. They were cruising, and then suddenly it all falls apart. Which is probably the story of the season for both teams, actually.
Because yeah,
they're not in any way consistent. They basically trip themselves up. All of that, and so we were discussing during the break that Ingolstadt maybe if they had that squad that they have now for the entirety of the season, it might have been different. It might have been that they would be more up there. I think actually when you look at that, and that even if you look at that game where you see like we have Muslim who's in there, Sapai is not even playing, but all these players that they added, and also some of those that they put into like their second team, like Stendera or Beister, or they just transferred out. Maybe if the structure and the coach would have been there at the beginning of the season, it would have looked different. And this is actually sort of that game sort of also points in that direction when you look at Florian Pick and all these players that came in. And they're important for the structure now and for the way they play. And this all looks good, but it's just too late. It might not even be too little too late because it's not little, but it's the gap is just so big that they can't bridge it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've spoken about it at length throughout the season about the importance of getting the coaching hire correct. It's very difficult, especially if your team lacks identity and is really uncertain of what direction they really want to go in. And you look at a team that's newly promoted, it was a third time's a charm essentially for Tomasz Oral to win a playoff game, playoff series against Osnabrück. They go in a different direction though. Roberto Patzold was the initial coach. That didn't really work, even though he'd been with the club for quite some time. Then they went with Andre Schubert, who no one really ever felt was going to be the right guy. And, we were all proven correct by that when he failed to win a game in, I think it was like 8 or 9 attempts. So that was, yep. And then Rudi Gurren was the right guy at the right time. Obviously, left Wiesbaden during the season. They've been a little bit better. They're at the best form they're at right now, but that's not saying a whole lot. And that's not trying to sound cynical. It's just that's the truth of the matter. They're really not that great. Auer, on the other hand, they've always found ways to defy relegations. Sandhausen's another one of those teams. But this year, I think you could see the writing was on the wall relatively early. The lack of squad bolstering when you lose guys like Kruger, Testrot. They seemed very lean to begin with as in terms of individual quality. And that's gone throughout the season where some teams can get bailed out by an individual player carrying the load. They don't have that at all. And it has shown that, when there's been games where they need someone to really take the assertive route, they've been unable to do so.
With Auer, what's also really, really sort of glaring is when you look at the structure of the squad, when you look at the minutes, you have about 35% of the minutes for players of 23 and under. You have about 35% of minutes for players 30 and older. Mm-hmm. And in that peak age group of like, where usually you say players between 24 and 29 are those who are most capable, they're at the peak of their power, they are the players you put the load on to carry your team, they put the team on their back. They only have about 30% of the minutes, so the whole structure of the squad is not in balance at all in Aue. And I think this is, when you look at squad building, this is actually squad building 101. You don't have a squad that's so disjointed by age. You don't have a squad that has hardly any peak age players if you want to compete, or even in this case, because they're not like, Aue does get the strongest players in the zweite Bundesliga, let's be honest. So, of course, if you don't get these players and then you structure your squad in that way, you put a whole lot of pressure on the coach because he needs to outperform all that structure. And that's not there, no matter who you get. I mean, apart from maybe if you get Dominique Tedesco, and you get lucky and get one of those people.
But,
You don't have that. And then, I mean, Spielewski was like an attempt to recreate that magic. And it failed because, well, yeah, he didn't get along with the, this is also something, I mean, the whole structure in Aue is, of course, pretty difficult to get along with Leonhard and all that. I mean, I'm always told he's such a nice guy in person, but whenever I look at him, I'm like, he gives me kind of strange vibes. And to work with somebody like that is probably difficult because, he, of course, he wants to get into, like, squat management, even though he's not from like the sporting side. So this team all, or this club always has difficulties, and up to a point they could compensate it, but now they're at that point where, and you still have rebuilding before you, because if you have like 35 or 36% of your minutes in players who are over 30, you know they're getting to the end of their contract, of their career. So you need to still restructure that. So once they're relegated, and let's be honest, these two teams are going to be the two teams that get relegated, you still have restructuring to do. And this is going to be tough for them next year also.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about getting relegated to the Zweite Bundesliga being very difficult for teams to make the bounce back. The Dritte Liga is also is a totally different beast. And we've seen teams just get completely lost in transition. Duisburg is a great case of that at the moment, where they're fighting for survival for the second consecutive season. They hadn't figured out Kaiserslautern have taken a while, let's be frank, a long time to get even close to tasting promotion.
Look at Würzburg, who are getting relegated after getting relegated.
Yeah.
It's a really, really tough division because the drop-off, and again, we were talking about this during the break, which we were talking about parachute payments in England. This, you don't have that in Germany when you drop from the Zweite to the Dritte, because it's like all your TV money just evaporates. I had to sort of look at that when Nürnberg were playing the playoff against Ingolstadt with that 96-minute saving by Fabian Schleusener. So all of that, you look at that, and it goes from 10 million to, I think, 800,000 euros a year. So to compensate that for any period of time is massive. And if you don't go straight back up, it's going to be really, really tough. As you said, Kaiserslautern is just the big case in point. You could, if you look at other clubs, I mean, Dresden always manages to get back when they go down. So they probably have a different structure that's sort of in there and compensates for that. But look at Osnabrück, they're not going back up. Braunschweig is struggling. They might get into that promotion relegation playoff. That's a crapshoot. You don't know what's going to happen. 60 München, no. They also came up, they were promoted a couple of years ago after going from second to fourth tier, but they're not a shoe-in to be promoted. All of that, it's so difficult to go back up again. And so for both of those teams, I mean, no, you look at Ingolstadt. They were relegated. They were coming from the Bundesliga. They get relegated to the Zweite Liga. They get relegated again. They fail to be promoted 2 years running, and one year they go up the second year, but you still see the structure has changed, and you always think, well, Ingolstadt, they have Audi in the background, but that they're not putting in that much money, and of course the structure has changed in the team. They had 1 year more in the Dritte Liga. They don't have all of that, so it's really, really difficult, and it'll be interesting to see what happens for both of these teams when they go down. Ingolstadt might be because of their youth system and they have some interesting players in that setup. They're better prepared than Aue. I think Aue, yep. when you look at the squad structure and you also look at the fact that some of their players are just low knees, this is going to be difficult for them.
Agreed. I know one team we can also add to that mix. We're talking about Magdeburg, who look like they're about to win the league. They were almost relegated in their first season back in the Dritte Liga, but they lucked out. They got Christian Tietz. But as they say, one man's trash is another's treasure. That was Hamburg, who would really rue when they play each other next season. That one will be one to watch for. Let's make a move before we start talking about more Dritte Liga football than Zweite Bundesliga football. Karlsruhe, Fortuna Düsseldorf. Both teams in the mid-table. Düsseldorf have seen an upturn in form with Daniel Thun coming in as manager. Again, another great example of how important getting that coaching hire right is and getting someone who can implement their system, especially with a core group of players. And obviously, Thun's task, a bit difficult entering midway through a season. But he's done quite a good job, let's be frank. He's turned them in the right direction. They weren't able to hold on to this one. Once again, blowing a lead. This one was a two-goal lead. They were really good in the first half. They had multiple chances. Ginczek had a couple of chances he really should have buried, but he got it at the third time of asking on 31 minutes. Whew, what a cross by Ruben Hennings, piercing the defense. And Ginczek with an easy effort on goal. Hennings would get in on the act. Khalid Narai, who's been one of his favourite assist makers, he found Hennings. Hennings with a wonderfully deft touch to beat Marius Gersbeck. And 2-0 into the break, and it seemed Düsseldorf looked comfortable. But the game really changed just after the hour mark. Daniel Gordon completely mugged Jordi Device inside the box, and then Device committed a cardinal sin, fouling Gordon. A really dumb foul. It just is unnecessary. And Device, who's been fantastic for Fortuna since he's come from Queen's Park Rangers, him and Hoffman have been very strong defensively. Oh, it was such a silly foul. Vanitek scores, and now it's game on. That 2-0 lead is one of the worst leads in football, because when you concede, oh, the pressure is on. And then they concede again. 83 minutes. Who else but Philip Hoffman? His 16th goal of the campaign. He beats Florian Kastenmeier. Another one where it kind of goes through a crowd of players. Kastenmeier's diving not where the football's going. and Hoffman gets it right in front of the ultra scene. Obviously, they're still rebuilding the Wildpark, but they were going ballistic. What a strange game, because Düsseldorf, you look at the stats and it seems inconceivable that Düsseldorf had so many great chances and didn't win this game. And yet, here we are.
It was really, really weird, because I thought they were cruising. I thought they were in control. And then you see how a game really can turn on such small things. And I mean, that was probably one of the worst penalties I've ever seen. Mm. It's like, why do you reach with your foot through the legs of your opponent? Why are you doing that? I mean, it's inconceivable. As you said, he's been such an asset for the campaigns after coming on over the winter. I think all the transfers that Düsseldorf has done over the winter, with Gavori, even though he's out now, with Ginczek, this is, along with Daniel Thun, is really, this is the reason why Düsseldorf have solidified, why they're no longer in like acute danger of being relegated or playing that relegation playoff. So, and then he does that and the game is just gone. It's just gone, and you have the 2-1, and then Hoffman just and really, really, really a strange goal, as you said, because where's the goalie going? But yeah, well, sometimes football works like that, and it's really interesting to see how also to see, because I at the beginning of the show, I talked about Guerino Caporetti, how he's changed this, and then with Tune, it's the same. You can also really see that he's developed the team in his direction. They're a lot more aggressive. This aggression also leads to like a lot of fouls, but they're there. They have a presence. They're making the opponent hurt, and that's good in that sense, because they need to work for that, and they're no longer, especially in the Zweite Bundesliga, you need to be physical, and now they are physical. So he's advanced that side without forgetting them also, that they also have to play football. Then with Ginzek and Hennings, you have a great pairing up front. So all of that works. And then suddenly, and you're thinking, well, that you're 2-0 up, you're sort of in control, and then it all just changes, and football's just weird like that. It's also weird that Daniel Gordon is the guy getting fouled, because he's like a central back and he's up front and he's like 89 years old, but he's still playing. It's really interesting. I wouldn't put it past Kazuo to like give him another contract even now, because he's been pretty good actually. Also interesting with Gordon, if you look at like the real positions on the pitch, he's up there on like the same level as Breithaupt, who's the number six player in that 4-3-3. And O'Shaughnessy is back like almost at the same level of Gaspek, which tells you how differently they interpret their center back roles, which is also interesting. But O'Shaughnessy also great addition for in the winter. So these teams really added depth and strength of the winter.
And I'm looking at like the current positional map of both teams. If you look at kind of like the starting players, and you can see the shape is very much in vogue for Dusseldorf. You know, you can see that very identifiable back four. Boateng's playing a little bit further, a little bit deeper in that setup. And then you look at Karlsruhe, and there's, you know, O'Shaughnessy's he's almost playing like a sweeper role. He's very deep defensively. Gordon's up where he's very close to even Gondorf. The fullbacks are very up forward, and then Lawrence and Batmaz, who came in to the starting 11. You know, they're both further forward than Hoffman, which is indicative of what Hoffman does. Likes to drop back, likes to be involved in the build up play. But yeah, very interesting to see how those teams went about it. It was definitely, the methodology was very different with what Christian Eichner was trying to do. But you could see at the end of the first half, he looked very despondent. You could see that he was like, well, we're getting absolutely smashed here. Something needs to change. And it took one incident and the game switched on its head. And, you know, sometimes when you get those two goals within 20 minutes, still a bit of time. We've seen teams steal games in game, and we've seen it on the weekend even, where teams can find ways to get results. And yeah, I mean, it's not going to change where they're going to finish in terms of like they'll be in mid-table, but yeah, it's quite fascinating. I feel as if Dusseldorf might be a team to watch for next season. I was a bit ahead of the curve, had them finishing second, but if Daniel Thun had started with them, maybe I would have been right, but I'll take the L on that one. Let's go to our final game of the match day. Hanover and Jan Regensburg. This game ended a goal apiece in the end. Andreas Albers opened the scoring. He's still remains Jan Regensburg's most potent striker. But moments later, they were reduced to 10 men. Carlo Bukalfa with a very dangerous tackle. And I don't know why he was surprised initially to see a straight red card. Because, you know, when I see studs up cannoning into the legs and you're not getting any of the ball, I mean, yeah, I mean that's grounds for Niklas Winter to immediately reach for the reddest card in the book. And then Hanover, 39 minutes in, ex-Jan Regensburg player Sebastian Stolzer heads in, and that was it. The game ended a goal apiece. It took some fantastic goalkeeping from Alexander Meyer, who... there may have been questions if he should have still been on the pitch after taking a bit of a head knock. But then he made that incredible save on Dominic Kaiser towards the end of the game. I mean, that was an unbelievably good save. And you can see Kaiser is in disbelief that the ball hasn't gone in because he's put his foot well through it. But again, this is another game where, you know, they had the man advantage. They had a lot of the ball. As is the theme, as you mentioned, Flo, that teams that had most possessions really struggled to win the game. Oh, how frustrating for the 9,000 fans that made it to the HDI Arena. You have the man advantage for 50-odd minutes, more than 50-odd minutes, an hour. And the fact you don't capitalize on that, that's a very disappointing display in the end.
Yeah, and that basically the thing is, the goal you get is also like not, if I have that correctly, it's off like a set piece. It's not directly off the corner, but it's set up from that, and he's still up. From play, they had both teams didn't create a whole lot, and it was probably the least exciting game of the weekend, and both teams sort of played the way they've been playing all season. It's not enough to be relegated, but it's not good enough to go anywhere where the action is, where it matters. So it was, yeah, you can sort of see that Regensburg are still sort of drawing from their big start, like they were when they started really well. And now if they hadn't had that start, they would probably be where Dresden is right now. So you can see that they have their problems. Also because Sapreet Singh is no longer performing the way he was in the first part of the season. So all of this coming together shows you their trouble. And on the other side, you see Hannover, who's also, they also have their problem. I'm not convinced that when it comes to Dabrowski, actually. I don't think he's the because we were talking about coaching hires. He's actually sort of moved the team backwards when it comes to like performing actively. He's turned them in a much more passive side than they were before. This is not true for that game all that much, because when you play against Ringsburg, usually you get to be a bit more active and you get the ball a lot, but as such, they're a lot more passive. They're also not controlling the ball as much as they used to. So I'm not convinced that's the right direction to go if you want to at one point again challenge, because I think Hannover is still at that point where they're saying, well, I want to challenge for promotion. And I don't see that happening in that current setup. Also with the current team, they never really got over losing Duksch, and they don't have that production up front. So, and I think Kak is their top scorer, which also says a lot about the team. All of that factoring in, and then if you combine these two teams, a subpar game.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't have said it better myself. It was probably not the first choice of the Saturday kickoff games for a lot of people. I mean, neither team has really shown enough this season, and yeah, we've said it multiple times on the podcast this season that the jury is out on Christoph Dabrowski. I mean, I think you look at where they were at, because they were at a very similar place to where Dusseldorf were, and they obviously went with Dabrowski, whereas Fortuna waited and then eventually went with Tune, who you can just see that those two teams have kind of very much gone in different directions. You know, Hannover still have to be a little bit wary of their position. They do have a 4-point cushion, but their form is very, very shaky at best. And they are rewarded by playing Erzgebirge Aue on the weekend. So away, which is usually a bit more trickier than playing them at home, must need to start picking up a couple of points just to ease the pressure heading into the end of the season. Before we go, of course, we like to talk about our kick tip. And our good friend Lewis Lerza, continues to lead 278 points. And just for good measure, he also topped the match day with 16 points. Kudos to you,
and
Lewis.
He won the internet with the car of his brother.
Yes, his brother with the Gunther Steiner on his car. Yeah, I absolutely love that. As a Formula One fan as well, I am a big fan of that. So he's done a lot of winning this weekend. And, of course, he commentated for the Hartford Horfunk, seeing Pascal Testereau, who I'm pretty sure he mentioned would have one of those kinds of days, and he did. Flo, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're welcome anytime. Where can our wonderful listeners find you on social media?
I'm at Flo_Singer on Twitter. I write for Club Fans United, which is clubfans-united.de. I also write a weekly column, which is called the Taktik Tafel, which is the tactics board for the Nürnberger Nachrichten, which is also available on nordbayern.de. And yeah, just reach out to me. You can also listen to me on Kadett, which is the podcast about FC Nürnberg, hosted by Nordbayern.de and the Nürnberger Nachrichten and the Nürnberger Zeitung. So you can find me there as well, and just get not only talk about football, but also about all things culinary in the region, which is sort of come as a way of talking about football, because you always talk about food as well.
That is some food for thought with that one. Of course, next week, Eva will be back. If you want to listen to Eva this week, you can listen to the Rasenfunk Schlusskonferenz. She was one of the panelists to discuss all the action from the Bundesliga. Go check that out. She will be back with us next week to discuss all the action from Match Day 29 in the Zweite Bundesliga. Until then, thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.